Well, today we kick off week number 31 of our 4.5 year journey, verse by verse, through all of God's inspired word. And we are in the book of Leviticus, which is a tech manual for the priests and the Levites to know exactly how they're supposed to carry out their actions as the representatives of the people to God and of God to the people. And so we've got a lot of details in this book. Much of it feels rather tedious to those of us trying to look at it. And sometimes we want to consider this of no real significance because it is part of the law that in the New Covenant we are no longer required to adhere to. And much of it is related to the temple or the tabernacle and to the Jewish nation in particular. And therefore, a lot of the Jewish believers, or excuse me, the Gentile believers, are just not all that into this stuff. But I think it's important for us to go through all of Scripture and to have kind of a grasp mentally of what these things were that were part of the Jewish community and how they were learning to follow God's lead even in the small bits of details in their life. Now, chapter number 11, we're talking about the diet of the Israeli people at this time. And God gives them some rules of thumb that allow them to determine very quickly whether or not an animal is on the menu. It's pretty easy for the quadrupeds, that is the four-legged animals, they have to have both a split foot or a split hoof, and they have to chew the cud. And so effectively, that means they pretty much eat cattle and sheep and goats, because those fall into the categories. Now, those are fairly safe meat animals because they eat a vegetarian diet and process it pretty well to make good protein. So that's that category easily done. Then we have the water animals, and the only thing that they're allowed to eat there would be those that have both fins and scales, which means pretty much the fish that actively swim in the water itself. So the things that just sit around on the bottom, such as catfish, which do have fins, but they don't have scales, the bottom feeders, or the things which basically sit on the bottom, like clams and oysters and things like that, where it's possible they're going to get a hold of contaminated things, those are off the menu. So there are some pragmatic things about these rules for the Jewish people that's going to promote them to be generally more healthy, because they're going to avoid the things that, unless they're processed properly, could lead to some health issues. When we were talking about the birds on the list were basically the birds that eat meat, and some of them specifically eat carrion, that is, dead animals. So any of the birds that do that, the Israelis were not supposed to eat. So pretty much we're talking about chickens and pheasants and quail, pigeons and doves. Seed-eating birds are the ones that are going to be on the menu for the Israeli people. Then we were talking most recently about bugs, insects. Now, when they classified insects, they talked about them being four-legged. We talk about them being six-legged. They kind of considered those front pair of legs as being arms. And so that's why these are called six-legged or four-legged. The only things among the insect world that they were allowed to eat were those that jumped. So pretty much grasshoppers, locusts, and crickets. That's the only thing that was on the menu. Those are all very good high-protein foods, by the way. I haven't tried anything other than the grasshoppers and the locusts, and they were okay. Never had crickets, although I suppose if they were properly prepared, I'd be willing to try them. Now, let's remind ourselves that they were told not just simply don't eat them, but don't touch them. And if you do touch them, you have to go through a water ceremony to get rid of that ceremonial uncleanliness. And then we get to a review verse in Leviticus 11, verse 26. Every animal that parts the hoof, but is not cloven or does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. Everyone who touches them shall be unclean. And all that walk on their paws among the animals that go on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean until the evening. We're talking about basically cats and dogs and things of that nature. Those are off the menu, and you're not even supposed to be moving their dead bodies around. Verse 28, and he who carries their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. They are unclean to you. So there's the water ceremony. Verse 29, let's go to another category. These are unclean to you among the swarming things that swarm on the ground. So what's a swarming thing? Basically things that live in the ground and are always there running around on the ground. The mole rat, the mouse, the great lizard of any kind, the gecko, the monitor lizard, the sand lizard, the chameleon. Basically, we'd even include alligators and crocodiles and things like that, I think. These are unclean to you among all that swarm. Whoever touches them when they are dead shall be unclean until the evening. Anything on which any of them falls when they are dead shall be unclean. Now, this is where we get into some pragmatic things around the house, because we all know that houses do get things like mice and lizards and other, quote, unclean animals in them. Things that you wouldn't eat, but which might die and be on your eating utensils, in your cooking utensils. So God gives them, through Moses, a mechanism to deal with that. So anything on which any of them falls when they are dead shall be unclean, whether it is an article of wood or a garment or a skin or a sack, any article that is used for any purpose, it must be put into water, and it shall be unclean until evening, then it shall be clean. So they basically have to wash anything that these unclean animals get on. If any of them falls into an earthenware vessel, all that is in it shall be unclean, and you shall break it. So they used earthenware vessels to contain things. So if you left the lid off of, say, your flour jar, and a mouse got in there, well, everything in the jar is now unclean. So you had to dispose of it, and also you disposed of the jar. You started with something fresh. So what would be the lesson to be learned from that? Keep your jars shut. Keep the lid on them at all times when you're not using them. If any of them falls into any earthenware vessel, all that's in it is unclean. You shall break it. Any food that's in it could be eaten, on which water comes, shall be unclean. And all drink that should be drunk from any such vessel shall be unclean. So liquid has to do with some of this too. Everything on which any part of their carcass falls shall be unclean, whether oven or stove, it shall be broken in pieces. These are pottery made ovens and stoves. So you're basically going to try to keep those sorts of equipment in a safe, protected area. In fact, when you're not using them, you might put a cover over them to keep them from becoming becoming contaminated. They are unclean and shall remain unclean for you. Nevertheless, a spring or a cistern holding water shall be clean, but whoever touches a carcass in them shall be unclean. So what if you've got like a well and you see a rat floating around in there? Well, you fish the rat out and then the water is considered clean by itself because that's what you used in order to make ceremonial cleanliness is water. Now, if you have like a whole ton of rats in there, I'm guessing they'd want to dig a whole new well. If any part of their carcass falls upon any seed grain that is to be sown, it's clean. But if water is put on the seed and any part of their carcass falls on it, it is unclean to you. So if they just fall dead in your sack of grain that you were planning on planting, you don't have to dispose of the grain. You can actually plant it. You just have to get rid of the carcass and wash yourself and you're unclean till evening. But if there is any type of liquid involved when the animal falls into the grain, every bit of the wet grain is considered to be contaminated and you get rid of it. If any animal which you may eat dies, whoever touches its carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and whoever eats of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening, and whoever carries the carcass shall wash his clothes and shall be unclean until evening. So butchers and stuff like that, I think, might be the ones that would be impacted by this. Every swarming thing that swarms on the ground is detestable. It shall not be eaten. Whatever goes on its belly, whatever goes on all fours, or whatever has many feet, any swarming thing that swarms on the ground, you shall not eat it, for they are detestable. What are we talking about here? Snakes and millipedes and centipedes. You shall not make yourselves detestable with any swarming thing that swarms. You shall not defile yourselves with them and become unclean through them. For I am he who is your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And this is the first time I think we've seen this in this book of Leviticus. It'll be repeated over and over again. It's basically the idea that God has standards that he is putting upon his people Israel, and they are supposed to represent him by living by these standards. These standards are to have a framework that will make the Israelis different than the people around them, that is, the Gentile peoples around them. I think there's some pragmatic things here that the Israelis are going to tend to be more healthy because of these standards. They're going to wash themselves more often. So hygiene is going to be more prevalent amongst the Israeli people. In fact, if you do a little bit of history research, you will find out that the hygiene standards we use in surgery now and in the medical field, and actually just in cleaning in general, can all be traced back to contributions from Jewish people. And what happened was, eventually, scientists figured out there is a pragmatic result that comes from these hygienic practices. We avoid the germs that are out there unseen in all of these things that we've been talking about. So there are good pragmatic things to be learned from many of these Levitical standards. Verse number 45, "For I am he who is, that brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." And this is the law about beast and bird and every living creature that moves through the waters and every creature that swarms on the ground, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the living creature that may be eaten and the living creature that may not be eaten. Now, in the New Testament period, we have some teaching in the book of Acts in particular, I think, is the anchor point, where Peter, who is Jewish, sees this sheet, this sailcloth apparently, coming down out of the heavens during a vision that he has. And there's all sorts of unclean animals by the standards that we've just been reading these. And these animals are all on this sheet. And Jesus then speaks to him and says, "Peter, rise, kill, and eat." And Peter's response is, "Lord, I've never eaten anything unclean or unkosher." And Jesus' response is, "What I've cleansed, don't call unclean." And this happens three times. And then we have the follow-up story with Peter going to Cornelius' house. And he understands that the main point of this vision was that Gentiles were to be given the gospel. They were not to be treated as unclean and unworthy of being saved. So that's the main spiritual point. But there was also the pragmatic side of things, that the kosher rules were no longer expected as the standard to be judged on all peoples. And Peter, when he has the gospel written through the hand of Mark, because that's pretty much the understanding of the gospel of Mark, is that Peter was the source of all this material. It includes a time when Jesus says that which goes into a man is not that which makes him unclean. It's that which comes out of his heart. You know, the bad attitudes, that's what makes him unclean. And Mark writes, probably at Peter's prompting, "By this, Jesus declared all foods clean." And so the New Testament understanding is that the kosher rules no longer apply. Now, what was their purpose? Well, we've already talked a little bit about that, in that they did have a better health effect for the Israelites living in the time period that they were living in, and even in time periods right up to our modern era. Now we have a better understanding of microbiology. We have a better understanding of parasites in certain types of meats and things like that. And so we now have procedures to avoid some of the dangers that they would have involved themselves in eating some of those foods. And so the times have changed. And so that's one of the things I think that may have allowed this change between the Old and New Covenants regarding kosher and unkosher foods. But we've also got this. Lessons are taught through everyday things that we engage in. Training takes place. Discipline is instilled. And I always like to use at this point an example of military service. Those of us who went through basic training or through boot camp, we had all sorts of rules and regulations put on us during that time of our training that then were removed later. Their major purpose was to get us in the mode of discipline and following rules and regulations. My best example of this is underwear folding. When I was going through basic training for the United States Air Force, I was taught that I had to fold my underwear in an exact 6-inch flat square. And if it was 6.5 inches or it wasn't square, I got dinged. I got a demerit for that. And so it taught me to be very attentive to a detail. Now, once I get out of basic training, that was never expected of me again. Because the purpose was training to follow directions and to follow the orders with great meticulous detail that are given to me later in my military career. And so the same thing is true about the law. And we see this in some of Paul's writings, that the law was a school training program. It was the mechanism by which the Jewish people were prepared for the coming of the Messiah, so that when he came, they would listen to him and follow his directives. In the book of Galatians, Paul said that the law was like a pedagogos, which was a slave that was charged with making sure that students, immature students, got to their teacher. And Paul says that once the teacher was gotten to by these students, the pedagogos had no more job. They had finished their purpose. And the same thing is true with the law. Once the law was fulfilled in Jesus coming on the scene, there was no more requirement for it to be adhered to like it had been previous to his coming. So that's the reason why Peter is told, arise, kill, and eat, even unkosher food, and why he makes sure that it's written in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus said that all foods are clean. And so I hope that that kind of helps us understand the distinction between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant when it comes to these food items here. Let's go ahead and go on to chapter number 12 in Leviticus now. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days. As at the time of her menstruation, she shall be unclean. Now, unclean is a little bit of a problem word here for us in our society, because we think of cleanliness in relationship to hygiene, dirty, something that is contaminated by germs or could pass along some sort of infection. That's not the way that the word is intended to be understood here. It's basically that she's on restrictions, or she is off limits for normal procedures. That's the idea of uncleanliness here. So if you've got a lady who has a baby boy, then for the next 7 days after his birth, she is supposed to be kind of on restriction, limiting her contacts. Same thing happens when she has her period. After she's finished her period, she's kind of on restriction for normal activity for the next 7 days after that. Verse number 3. On the 8th day, that is the 8th day after the birth, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. So this is the day of the circumcision ceremony. This is the day on which he is given his name in the covenant. Something similar happens with the girls, although there is no circumcision that takes place. Verse 4, then she, meaning mom, shall continue for 33 days in the blood of her purifying. So additional 30 days of limited restrictions, of limiting her activities with other people. So it's basically she's going to spend 40 days with her newborn baby. She shall not touch anything holy, so she's not going out to worship service, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purifying are completed. If she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks, so 14 days after the birth, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying for 66 days. So we've basically got 80 days of mom spending time with her newborn baby girl. When the days of her purifying are completed, whether for a son or a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting a lamb a year old for a burnt offering and a pigeon and turtle dove for a sin offering. And he shall offer it before he who is and make atonement for her. Then she shall be clean from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, either male or female. So this is the re-entrance into society, regular, ordinary interaction after the birth of a newborn. So it's 40 days for a boy child and 80 days for a girl child. If she cannot afford a lamb for this sacrifice, she shall take two turtle doves or two pigeons, one for a burnt offering, the other for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her, and she shall be clean. And we see this passage referenced in the story of Jesus, where Mary and Joseph, 40 days after the birth, show up at the temple with a couple of birds as their sacrifice because they're dirt poor. That's all they can afford. And it is on this day that Jesus then, with his parents, is introduced to society at large. And it's on this day, of course, two prophets, a male and a female prophet, meet the Holy Family and make predictions about his future as the atoning sacrifice for sin. All right, so we're almost out of time for today. So when we come back tomorrow, we're going to get into chapter number 13, where leprosy is the topic. And I want to just give you a heads up. Leprosy, I do not believe in any way, shape, sense, or form is a disease. I believe it is a specific mark by God that should be equated with behavior. And it's actually equivalent to the process for church discipline in the New Testament. And we'll see this as being symbolic of that. So get yourselves ready, and tomorrow we'll get right back into the Word.